having invited me, first of all, I have to apologize. I feel like a little bit of an imposter here because my talk is going to be concerned with linear wave equations. And this is an audience of, you know, world-class researchers in nonlinear wave equations. So I need to apologize for that. But these are linear wave equations in an interesting space-time geometry. And I think there is probably some merit to the exercise that I will be going through today. My talk is the last talk in the morning. You must all be tired. I promise that I'll try to be done before 1 o'clock, okay? So in about 35 minutes, so you can all go and have lunch. Okay, so this is joint work with Felix Finster at the University of Regensburg, Joel Smoller at Michigan, and Xingtung Yao at Harvard. Okay, so let me just set the stage for the problem that I would like to talk about today. So what we've been interested in is looking at the long-term behavior of solutions of linear wave equations in black hole geometries. In fact, space-time geometries corresponding to equilibrium states of rotating black holes. I mean, that such a study should be at all possible is sort of the result of a number of, you know, miraculous results. The first of these miraculous results is a uniqueness theorem, which characterizes in very, very simple terms what the space-time geometry corresponding to a rotating black hole in equilibrium is going to look like. So since this is not an audience of relativists, I thought I should spend time setting the stage and, you know, not too much time on the technical details of the proofs of the theorems. So the first miracle is a classical result. This is textbook material in general relativity, which is known as the black hole uniqueness theorem, goes back to the late 60s and mid-80s work of Werner Israel and Brandon Carter. So what these people did was to set up a boundary value problem for the Einstein field equations, in this case the Einstein-Maxwell equations, which couple gravity to electromagnetism, whereby the boundary conditions would encode what you would expect on a reasonable physical basis, the space-time geometry of corresponding to a rotating black hole in equilibrium to be. So the theorem says that if you take a space-time, a four-dimensional manifold, endowed with the Lorentzian metric, you make some global assumptions about time orientability, causality, so the non-existence of time-like or null closed curves. If you assume that there exists an event horizon, if you make some symmetry assumptions, namely that the space-time geometry is just axisymmetric, so you have a space-like Killing vector with closed orbits and a non-degenerate axis of symmetry, and if you also assume that the space-time is pseudo-stationary, this encodes the hypothesis that you have an equilibrium state, this means that you have a Killing vector which is time-like at sufficiently large distances. And finally, if you impose that the space-time is what is called weakly asymptotically simple, so it's an asymptotic flatness condition at null infinity, which would correspond to a isolated physical system, an event horizon, that's something that you need to describe a black hole with a good topology, so an event horizon homeomorphic to R cross S2, and if you also assume that the topology of space-time around the event or outside the event horizon is also something fairly simple, namely R2 cross S2, then there is an amazing uniqueness theorem which says that with these boundary conditions, if you impose the Einstein-Maxwell equations, which couple gravity to electromagnetism, you get a unique set of solutions which are very simply parameterized by three parameters. These were solutions which had been known before from the early 60s. This is the so-called Kerr-Newman family of solutions of the Einstein Maxwell equations. I mean, the exact form of the metric is not so important. What is important to keep in mind is that this metric depends on three parameters, m corresponding to the mass of the black hole measured from infinity, q corresponding to the charge, and a corresponding to the angular momentum per unit mass. And what this condition here says is that angular momentum and charge cannot be too large relative to the mass of the black hole. The event horizon is given by a very, very simple equation, namely R equals R1, which corresponds to the largest of the two roots of this quadratic polynomial. And when this angular parameter, momentum parameter A tends to zero, the space-time geometry becomes spherically symmetric, and you recover the famous Schwarzschild or Reister-Nordström solution corresponding to a spherically symmetric black hole in equilibrium. So mass, charge, and angular momentum cannot be defined locally in general relativity. They're measured asymptotically. With the boundary conditions that we have imposed, these are simply defined as, you know, computing fluxes on spherical cross-sections of non-infinity. Okay? So basically, you take these Killing vectors, the one that corresponds to the pseudo-stationary action, the one that corresponds to the axisymmetric character of the geometry. You take the gradient, you take the Hodge dual of the gradient, you integrate it on this sphere, and this gives you a conserved quantity. And this is how mass, charge, and angular momentum are defined. Something important that, if I have time, I will come back to a little bit later in my talk, is that there is nothing sort of particularly bad about the fact, show you the metric again. I mean, the components of the metric tensor here are undefined anytime delta vanishes. Delta in particular vanishes along the event horizon, where R corresponds to the largest root of this quadratic polynomial. But there is nothing sort of intrinsically or geometrically bad about this. In fact, you can analytically extend or continue the metric across the event horizon and construct a manifold with countably many charts, which is a maximal extension of this outer region in the sense that it's as close to being geodesically complete as it could be. Okay? So the only incomplete geodesics are the ones that end up at the ring singularity at R equals zero. And the charts are organized in this fashion, so the metric I showed you is a metric which lives in this outer region of this maximal analytic extension. But for physical reasons, one should also be interested in what happens between R equals R1 and R equals R0. R equals R0 is what's called the Cauchy horizon. It's very important from the point of view of the initial value problem. And for physical reasons, one should also be interested at the behavior of fields in this region. And maybe if I have time, I will mention one theorem of that nature. Okay, what else can I tell you about the Kerr metric? Something very, very important, namely that, remember, the way in which we've set things up, this black hole has angular momentum, which corresponds to this parameter A, angular momentum per unit mass, and the presence of angular momentum does something really funny to the geometry. Namely, if you compute the norm squared of this Killing vector d by dt in the geometry, in the metric corresponding to the Kerr metric, then you see that d by dt, which is time-like, sufficiently far from the event horizon, changes causal type even in a region which lies outside the event horizon. You do a little calculation. I mean, the event horizon corresponds to the largest of the two roots of r squared minus 2mr plus a squared. Well, outside the event horizon, this polynomial here will change sign, and this polynomial controls precisely the normed square of d by dt. So there is this open region outside the event horizon, which is called the ergosphere. Don't ask me why they call it the ergosphere. I mean, the presence of this ergosphere is tied to the fact that the black hole has angular momentum. It's sort of like a whirlpool effect that takes place because of the angular momentum of the black hole. But it's absolutely, it's time orientable. The space-time geometry is time orientable, but you can't use d by dt to do that. Absolutely, that's right. But these are not orbits of Killing vectors, and d by dt is a Killing vector. Absolutely. Okay. See, we're interested in Killing vectors because eventually we want to study wave equations and the behavior of solutions of wave equations in this geometry, and we need some notion of energy and how we're going to get the energy. Well, we need to look at the Killing vectors of the metric. And here we're going to run into some trouble. Okay. So what's the general program? Well, the general program is really to look at this whole chessboard of linear wave equations and curved space-time. And each of these linear wave equations governs some form of linear perturbation in the case of the Kerr-Newman solution of a rotating black hole in equilibrium, and the fields are characterized by their spin and their mass. So spin 0 corresponds to scalar fields, spin 1/2 corresponds in the massless case to neutrinos, spin 1 corresponds to electromagnetic waves, spin 3/2 is a bit esoteric, but this is tied to a linearized supergravity. This is the Rarita-Schwinger equation. Spin 2 is very important. The equation for spin 2 governs gravitational waves. I mean, we all know about gravitational waves in Minkowski space, and those are well understood. Gravitational waves near a black hole need to be understood, and these are governed by a certain PDE that I may write down for you if I have the time. But there's a spin parameter which describes the type of field that you consider. And there is also a dichotomy between massless and massive fields. So massive fields of spin 0 are governed by the Klein-Gordon equations, and massive spins of spin 1/2 are governed by the Dirac equation. In today's talk, I would like to talk mostly about the Dirac equation and a little bit about the scalar wave equation, if time permits. Okay. Sure. Yes. Yes.
How do I tell what spin?
Uh-huh. Absolutely. So these are all, I mean, except for spin 0, these are all vector equations. And, I mean, again, it's the genius of Chandrasekhar and that I will refer to in a moment, who's taught us how to take these vector equations and massage them to get good scalar equations that you can work with. First, in the massless case. In the massive case, as you will see in a moment, you really need to deal with these vector equations head on. How do you write down the equation? Well, this is sort of basic representation theory. If you have a field of spin S, it lies in a vector bundle associated to a given representation of the universal cover of the Lorentz group. And basically, a field of spin S, for representation theoretic reasons, will be represented by a section of a vector bundle of rank 2S plus 1. S equals 0, it's scalar. S equals 1/2, you already have four components to deal with in the massive case, two components in the massless case. So the number of components grows. Here you have five components, which are complex valued in the case of gravitational waves. Five components, complex valued, that's 10 real valued fields. These correspond to the 10 independent components of the Weyl conformal curvature tensor in four dimensions. So you're looking at perturbations, equations governing perturbations of the conformal curvature tensor. Yeah? So it's 5 times 2, which equals 10, which equals vial over here. There's a little bit of representation theory.
So for your spinners, are you considering the rack spinners and vial spinners for the...
Yes. But the results, so the question was, are you considering Dirac spinners and vial spinners? Dirac spinners have non-zero mass, and the answer is yes. I'll be writing some theorems for the theorems I will write will work whether the mass is zero or not. But the statement is richer when the mass is non-zero. And that's why I will state them for non-zero mass. The other theorems, I will just state them for the wave equation. I won't state them for the Klein-Gordon equation. Okay. So, let me tell you a little bit of history. So, you know, if you're a physicist and you're studying black holes, the basic question that you're wondering about is whether black holes are stable or not. The pioneering work on black hole stability goes back to Regé and Wheeler in the late 50s, who studied the mode stability, so the stability of individual modes governing perturbations of the Schwarzschild spherically symmetric black hole. But they used metric perturbations, so they used the components of the metric as fields to be perturbed. It's only much later that people realize that it's much better to work with the perturbed curvature tensor rather than the perturbed metric, because out of the curvature tensor you can construct invariants which don't care about your coordinate system. And if you're a geometer and a good physicist, you don't want to worry about coordinates too much. And that took quite a while. The main work there is due to Price. And in the spherically symmetric case, and Tucholsky in the case with angular momentum. So these people wrote down amazingly interesting equations governing spin 2 and less perturbations of the Schwarzschild metric or the Kerr metric, equations which have all the right gauge invariant properties that you would like. So they're they govern quantities which are not dependent on the choice of coordinates, govern geometric quantities. There's been a lot of work on Schwarzschild, very little serious analytic work on Kerr. In a moment you will see why the Kerr case is so much more complicated. There's been a lot of numerical work being done on Kerr, and Chandrasekhar in the 70s and 80s undertook an incredibly baroque task of studying the scattering of waves, electromagnetic and gravitational, by the Kerr black hole, but you know it still needed the support of numerical techniques. And there is a famous bet between Kip Thorne and Chandrasekhar as to whether the Kerr black hole should be stable, linearly stable under gravitational perturbations, because Chandrasekhar didn't believe in numerical arguments. And that was finally settled just in the case of individual modes by Bernard Whiting, who was a postdoc of Stephen Hawking in the late 80s. So these are quite complicated equations. What I would like to talk about in I think, most of the remainder of my talk is just the Dirac operator. So the question is to know what you can say about the long-time behavior of solutions of the Dirac equation in the Kerr geometry of a rotating charged black hole. And I will, at the very end, just mention a little bit what happens for scalar fields. For those of you who are not that familiar with the Dirac operator, I think actually I'm using this capital D like this in my remaining slides. So the Dirac operator is it's a matrix differential operator, as we mentioned before. It's an operator which acts on sections of a vector bundle of rank 4 over Kerr space-time. So it acts on row vectors of functions locally. Its solutions describe wave functions for massive particles of spin 1/2 in space-time. These coefficients, gamma, are 4 by 4 matrices, and they're constrained by the requirement that their anti-commutator should be a diagonal matrix proportional to the metric tensor. So they should generate Clifford algebra in the tangent space at each point. So you can do tensor calculus on spinor fields just like you do tensor calculus with tensor fields. There is an analog of the Levi-Civita connection when you're acting on spinors, defined by the following formula. It's just a big complicated matrix that involves first derivatives of the gammas, which themselves are related to first derivatives of the metric. So the order of, differentiation is reasonable. These are really correspond to, connection coefficients. And then if you throw in an electromagnetic field, well, you've got this abelian gauge field that contributes to it. Okay. Let me now, let me also mention, that's something very, very important, that there is a natural scalar product or inner product which is defined for spinor fields, spin one-half fields on, curved space-time. So you pick any space-like hypersurface and you pick a, say, a pair of compactly supported spinors on this space-like hypersurface, and you compute the contraction of the following quantity against the future pointing unit normal to the surface. Well, the conservation of this Dirac current guarantees that the value of the integral is independent of the choice of space-like hypersurface that you make. It's a conserved current, and it gives rise to an inner product which is positive definite. So this is good news, because this means that if you're trying to prove any kind of decay theorem for Dirac spinor fields on curved space-time, the problem that I mentioned with this d by dt Keeling vector becoming space-like, so energy becoming negative inside the ergosphere, the Dirac operator doesn't see that. And this is something very important. This is another miracle that makes this work. But the third miracle, in my opinion, is the best. And I'll mention this to you in a moment. Okay. Let me just present you with a few theorems that will give you a flavor of the results that one can prove on Dirac fields in the Kerr geometry. So this is, in some sense, in terms of the hypotheses I can make on the Cauchy data, almost the best theorem that we have. So I'm just assuming that the Cauchy data are bounded near the event horizon and otherwise in L2. And I'm interested in solving the Dirac equation with such Cauchy data. And the theorem says that if you take a space-like hypersurface t equals constant, and you take a compact annular region in that space-like hypersurface, then the integral of the Dirac current on this compact region will tend to zero, no matter what region you choose. Even if it's very, very large, this integral will tend to zero as t tends to infinity. No, the Dirac current has a probabilistic interpretation. If you integrate the Dirac current over a compact spatial region, what this gives you at any instant of time is the probability to find a Dirac particle in that compact region. And what this theorem tells you is that a spin one-half particle either has to escape to infinity or to cross the event horizon and fall into the black hole. But it can't stay confined in any other region of space-time forever, with probability greater than zero. Before I forget what I was going to say, with weaker assumptions, or stronger, it's a more restrictive assumption on the Cauchy data, I can make this theorem quantitative. I'll show this to you in a moment. Yes? Definitely. In this theorem, I have.
So what sort of boundary conditions are you
putting? I'm just putting boundary conditions, just boundedness at the event near the event horizon, that's all. It's pretty weak. I have another theorem, where I'm definitely allowing initial data to be supported across the event horizon. This takes us back to this picture I showed you earlier. You remember this maximal analytic extension of the Kerr metric. So the next theorem concerns solutions of the Dirac equation in this big manifold. But the conclusion is weaker. All it says is that if you're looking for time periodic solutions, which are L2 relative to this inner product that I just defined, then they must be trivial. But this is a theorem for solutions which are fairly, which are fairly weak regularity. I mean, they're supported across the event horizon, so these are distributional solutions. These are weak solutions. And the theorem says that these have to be identically zero. The proofs of the first and the second theorem are extremely different. I will say a few words about the proof of the first theorem, but not about this one at all. If you're interested, I can talk about this with you later. Okay. Third theorem is a theorem in which this behavior where Dirac fields fall into the cross the event horizon and fall into the black hole or escape to infinity becomes quantitative. But there I have to make far more restrictive assumptions about the Cauchy data. I need to take Cauchy data, which are unfortunately compactly supported outside the event horizon. I mean, this is definitely not very physical. And I also have to assume that there are this is a finiteness of angular modes condition. I'll get to this in a moment. But basically, you should think of initial data which are just unrestricted in terms of their energy spectrum, other than what follows from them being infinity with compact support. And also, you need to assume that the charge of the Dirac particle and the black hole are small relative to the mass. And there you have some really quantitative stuff. So everything depends on the behavior of the energy spectrum at the boundary of the mass gap in flat space-time. You know, the Dirac equation in flat space-time, like the Klein-Gödel equation, has a mass gap. This mass gap is not present in curved space-time. We'll see that in a moment. So you can have initial data which are supported non-trivially within this mass gap. But the behavior of the initial data near the boundaries, plus or minus m, of this interval is critical. You'll see, I'll tell you what psi 2 is in a moment. This is not very important. But basically what the theorem says is that if the behavior of the energy spectrum near the boundary of this interval is generic, so if these limits are non-zero, then the Dirac field will decay locally in L infinity log in time of the order of t to the minus 5/6. It's very interesting. So this is slower than what happens in Minkowski space, right? In Minkowski space, the decay is in t to the minus 3/2. And, you know, I mean, intuitively or physically, this is fairly reasonable. I mean, you know, the wave function wants to spread out. The gravitational field is trying to slow this down. Eventually, you know, the wave function wins. It will spread out, but there is a price to pay, and the price is that it goes more slowly. This rate is sharp, by the way. I'll explain this to you in a moment. Let me not bother with probabilities. Let me just wave my hands and tell you that you can also write down a formula for the probability of the Dirac particle to escape to infinity or to cross the event horizon in terms of the energy spectrum of the initial data. And again, this will be strictly less than one or strictly positive, depending on the behavior of the energy spectrum near the boundary of the mass gap. Okay, where does this rate of t to the minus 5/6 come from? Perhaps I can show this to you on a little diagram that I have here. Okay. So this is something very, very interesting. You remember, I said that in Minkowski space you have this forbidden interval, this mass gap, and generically the behavior of the Fourier transform or the energy spectrum as you approach, as omega approaches m, is in square root of omega minus m. Okay? So first derivative is discontinuous, and it just stops right there. In the curve geometry, it's very interesting. I mean, the curvature of the background geometry somehow interacts with the behavior of the Fourier integral here, omega equals m. And some estimates, if I have the time to show them to you, I'll flash them by you. Some estimates tell you that actually this Fourier transform is going to oscillate very, very fast as omega approaches m. And it's basically by adding up these oscillations that you get this slower rate of decay. So it oscillates more, it decays more slowly. And you know, there is a fun little exercise, you know, a while to do, to figure out. So this 1 over square root of alpha is the leading order term, 1 over square root of m minus omega coming from here. And then there is a nice oscillatory integral calculation that I'm sure, you know, Hardy could have done on the back of an envelope to get this result. Okay? So, absolutely. That's right. Well, the fact that it's more slow. Yeah, absolutely. That's right. So, exactly. And this came as a big surprise to us. I mean, our first guess was that, you know, somehow the rate of decay should interpolate between the rate of decay in Minkowski space and then, you know, rapid decay, which is what happens for massless particles. But it's not the case at all. It's really a local effect. And but our first, I remember I gave a preliminary talk about this stuff here a while ago, and I even wrote a guess which was completely wrong. And it took us a while to, yeah, exactly, it's completely wrong. So, yeah. Well, that's right. Well, Yao, of course, is it's great to one of the wonderful things that come, you know, with working with him is that he's not shy at all when it comes to talking to physicists, and they've been quite interested in this. Also, in connection with black hole evaporation. I mean, I should say that the physicists are interested in these results because we're writing, you know, spectral decompositions for Dirac propagators in curved space-time. If you ever want to do a black hole evaporation rigorously, you need to have good control on these propagators. That's why physicists are interested in this. But why t to the 5/6? Well, we don't really know. Let me mention the miracle that, in my opinion, makes all of this work. And this miracle is tied to Chandrasekhar, the great astrophysicist. So the story, as it was told to me by Brandon Carter, is as follows. So you remember I gave you this little historical synopsis of what happens for perturbations in spherical symmetry in the axisymmetric case. And I mentioned that Tucholsky had been able to write down to massage these systems of equations to get wave equations that were manageable. Well, they're manageable because these zero rest mass wave equations are separable in the Kerr metric. So it's quite extraordinary. I mean, you only have two killing vectors to play with, but somehow you can still separate variables completely in these wave equations. So for zero rest mass fields, people, you know, came up with various explanations for this. And the challenge was to do the same thing for massive fields. And Brandon Carter told me that Chandra was visiting him in Meudon once. And you know, Chandrasekhar had the reputation of being having supernatural computational abilities. And Brandon asked him whether he could separate variables in the Dirac equation in the Kerr metric. And I think a couple of months later, out comes this preprint where Chandra does things like this. I just want to show this to you briefly because I you know, it's a lesson that one should never give up if one believes in that the result should be true. This is my own, you know, reinterpretation of what Chandra did. So the key is that you're dealing with an operator which acts on sections of the vector bundle. So separation of variables is not simply a choice of coordinates, it's also very much a choice of frame. So you need to know what basis you're going to choose in the fiber above each point. Of course, the frame is given to you up to the full Lorentz group, if you're in a tangent space at each point. So you need to use some geometry to pick up the appropriate frame. And this is exactly what happens. So, I mean, the curvature tensor, the Weyl curvature tensor in curve geometry is not generic. It's very non-generic. It's got a pair of repeated principal null directions. And the idea is to construct a null frame from the metric, for the metric, starting from these principal null directions adapted to the curvature, and then use some discrete symmetries to construct a frame for the whole, the basis for the whole tangent space. This is what Chandra did, and so you get the Dirac operator in this special frame, and then you forget about what happens in spherical symmetry. You see, in the spherically symmetric case, when A equals zero, if you let the mass and the charge of the black hole tend to zero, you recover Minkowski space in spherical coordinates. Well, it's textbook problem to separate variables to the Dirac equation in Minkowski space in those coordinates. In the Kerr coordinates, you can still let M go to zero and Q go to zero. You end up with flat space as well. But then you end up, instead of having flat space in spherical coordinates, you have flat space in oblate spherical coordinates. So the spheres are flattened at the poles. And that's sort of the key idea that gets things going. Essentially, you take the Dirac operator, you conjugate it by a suitable multiplication operator, you take linear combinations, and instead of having the separation of variables that you get in the spherically symmetric case, the operator splits into a radial and an angular part. Angular, where the angular simply means not the angle along the around the axis of symmetry, but the azimuth measured from the axis of symmetry. Okay? That's the only coordinate you've left. So you do that by, you know, amazing thinking. And lo and behold, this conjugated Dirac operator splits into the sum of two pretty tricky-looking objects. Remember, these are matrix differential operators, and you're dealing with four-component wave functions. The point is that this is radial and this is angular. In fact, these radial and angular operators are first-order operators that you can write down. And lo and behold, if you now further separate the radial and angular coordinates, you end up with a coupled system of two coupled systems of first order ODEs, which, you know, I'm writing here. So why is this complicated? Well, this is complicated because, you know, in spherical symmetry, this lambda would correspond to the total angular momentum, which would be, you know, L times L plus 1. In the case where you have axis symmetry, I mean, lambda remembers the fact that there is axis symmetry, and lambda unfortunately depends explicitly on the energy and on K, on the projection of the angular momentum on the axis. And the whole, you know, complexity of this problem stems from the fact that you need to understand how lambda changes with the energy in a uniform way, because you would like to solve the Cauchy problem for Cauchy data where the energy spectrum is supported on the entire real line. So you need to get good uniform estimates in omega and in k. And that's the that's essentially what we've done. Maybe I'll just tell you very briefly because my time is out. I mean, you use the Hermann-Weyl method. So you take a radial box, you put Dirichlet boundary conditions on the radial box. Well, with those Dirichlet boundary conditions, lambda, the spectrum is discrete. And then what you do is that you let, you see what happens when you let one of the walls of the box tend to the event horizon, and then when you let the other one go to infinity, and you write down the the spectral decomposition of the propagator, and you see how the Riemann sums go over to a Riemann integral. And to understand how that is done, you need to have good uniform estimates on the spectral gaps. And that's the heart of the paper, is how to get those. 30 seconds, just to mention what happens for the scalar wave equation. See, the scalar wave equation, you don't have the luxury of being able to work in a Hilbert space because the energy is not positive definite. In fact, it's some work, but you can prove that there is no positive definite conserved current for the wave equation in the Kerr geometry unless the angular momentum is zero. So if you play the Hermann Weyl trick, you have no choice. You're going to pick up a real spectrum, discrete spectrum, but also complex eigenvalues, which reflect the lack of positivity. The good news is that for any box, the number of complex conjugate pairs that you get is finite. The bad news is that as you let the walls of the box go to the horizon and to infinity, the number of these complex conjugate pairs increases. No. What's remarkable is that the imaginary part tends to the real axis. That's the real miracle. So at the end, you are left with a nice workable spectral decomposition for the propagator for the scalar wave equation as well. And this, my God, I mean, this took us a long time to understand. Because you need to get these estimates again uniformly. So not uniform estimates are useless. Okay. So look, it's 1:05. I think I'll stop. Thank you very much. It's a good idea.